We had talked, back in 2018, so a year ago or so, we talked about Jesus before he was Jesus. And we talked about how, even before he came and was born of Mary, he existed, and we talked about some of the things that he did or how he was involved in the Old Testament times and things of that nature. But we want to carry on with that same kind of an idea by looking not necessarily at the things that Jesus did in the Old Testament, but of the foreshadows of Jesus. There's a pattern in the Bible of what is often called type and antitype. I refer to it as foreshadows and then the reality. A lot of times in a story, the foreshadowing of this is going to be something that's going, you don't necessarily even notice it when it happens, but then when the follow-up happens in that book or movie or whatever it is, you think, oh, I remember back at the beginning this happened, and oh, they were giving me a hint of what was coming. Well, God certainly does that in the Bible. There are times throughout the Old Testament where someone or something is mentioned in the Scriptures, and it's shown that this, when we get over into the New Testament, that person or that thing was a foreshadow of what Jesus was going to be. The clearest ones are actually stated very basically. Like Adam, for example. We'll start with him. Adam is explicitly stated to have been a type of Christ, and in that he was an example of a first. He was the first man. In Romans chapter 5, and beginning in verses 12 through 21, this talks about how Adam is like Christ, and of course they're different as well. A type or a foreshadow, no shadow of the thing is the actual thing. And so when there's a foreshadow of Christ in the Scriptures, it's kind of like just seeing a blurry, shadowy image of it, of what he's going to become. Augustine put it this way: the New Testament is the Old Testament contained, or concealed, some would say, to turn that phrase. The old is by the new explained. So some would say, the Old Testament is the new concealed. The New Testament is the Old Testament revealed. And so we see the revelation of everything that God wanted for us. But it's because of God's foreknowledge, because of his ability to know everything at all times. And how God interacts with time. Dawn and Xander and I were talking about this just the other day. How odd it is. We don't understand it. For us, we know what happened yesterday, and we know what's happened so far today. But beyond that, we have to guess at what's going to happen later on, tonight or tomorrow. We're just kind of guessing. We don't know. But for God, he can see tomorrow just as clearly as we've seen today. And he can see tomorrow just as clearly as he saw yesterday. And so it's a very difficult thing for us to comprehend that. But he looks at these things, and because of the way that he looks at it, he could shine the light from the time of Christ back into the Old Testament and leave these shadows everywhere for people to look forward to the time when Christ would come. And so he does that. And with Adam, he says, just as one man, by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men because all have sinned. For under the law sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed where there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the same way as Adam's transgression. Who is the figure, this translation says, some say type, of the one who was to come. But not as the offense, so also is the free gift. For if through the offense of one many died, then how much more has by one man, how much more the grace of God and the gift of grace by one man, Jesus Christ, has abounded to many. And he goes on to explain it a little bit more, but he basically makes this comparison. Adam was the first man, but he brought death into the world because of sin. He brought sin into the world. But Jesus is the first one who brings righteousness. And it's because of him that we can have eternal life. And so he makes this comparison all throughout Romans chapter 5. But then also we see Abel, Adam's son, is also a type of Christ, a reminder of Christ. Abel was the first innocent person killed because of the wickedness and sinfulness of others. Now, Abel certainly did not die as an atonement or as a sacrifice for others' sins. But we see the idea of the innocent being killed by the wicked in the same way that Jesus is. But he says in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 24, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. God, when he talked to Cain, when he told Cain that he knew that Abel had been murdered, he talked about how Abel's blood was crying up from the ground where it had been spilt. Well, Jesus' blood cries out too, but in a different way. Abel's blood cried out for vengeance and justice against Cain, who had killed him. But Jesus' blood cries out for forgiveness and mercy to all who deserve death because of what we've done to him. And so even though both bloods cry out, the blood of sprinkling, that blood of that new covenant that Jesus brought, speaks better things. I mean, how many of us would much rather have the cry be for mercy and forgiveness rather than for vengeance and justice? And so we see that with Abel and his blood being shed, a foreshadow of Christ and his blood being shed. And then there is Abraham's seed. In Galatians 3:16, Paul very clearly explains that, yes, we know that Abraham's seed, there was a promise made to Abraham, in your seed will all nations of the world be blessed. Now, some people thought that was going to be Isaac. Abraham thought maybe it was going to be Ishmael. The Jewish people thought, well, it was to us. We're the ones that are going to bless everybody. But Paul makes it very clear in Galatians 3 and verse 16. He says, now to Abraham and his seed were the promises made. He says, not to seeds as of many, but seed as of one. And to your seed, which is Christ. So Abraham's seed, that promised seed, yes, God was promising Abraham that he would have a son, Isaac, but it was going much further than that. The foreshadowing went way further than just saying, well, you're going to have a child. It was saying, you're going to have a descendant down there that is going to bring blessings to the whole world. And Paul says that was Christ. He's the one. Isaac didn't do it. The Jewish people didn't do it. But Jesus did. He was the seed that was promised and fulfilled. The promises made to Abraham that his children would be as the sands of the seashore. We could say, well, physically, yes, that happened through Isaac. But spiritually, that happened through Jesus Christ. Because now, not only his physical descendants, But all who are the children of Abraham just by faith. Because Abraham is the father of the faithful. And so we all get to be Abraham's descendants in that respect, of whatever nation we're from. And then, of course, Isaac, who was Abraham's immediate seed, his immediate offspring. But Isaac also is a type of Christ. In Genesis 22, verses 2 through 8, when Abraham is called to take Isaac up on the mountain, to go up and to sacrifice him. And Abraham went. He took Isaac with him. He took the wood. He took the fire. He took the knife. He took the rope to bind him. He took some servants to go with him a certain distance. And then he tells them to stay there. And he says, we're going to go over there and worship. And then come back to you. Now that phrase, and we'll come back to you, is an interesting one. The Hebrew writer says that what Abraham was thinking in his mind at that point was, basically, I'm going to sacrifice him, and then God's going to bring him back from the dead. Now that's something, because to Abraham, the bringing back from the dead was not something that was a commonly understood idea in his day. But that's what it says in Hebrews 11, that Abraham believed that if God could give me a child at 100 years old, then if I sacrifice this child to God, God can bring him back from the dead. That's what Abraham believed. And so when he says, we're going to go worship and we're going to come back, he wasn't lying. He wasn't trying to deceive those men. He really believed they were going to come back. But he also fully believed that he was going to kill his son up on that mountain. That was what he went with the intention of doing. And in fact, he got Isaac asked, you know, Father, well, here's the fire and the wood. Where's the lamb? And Abraham says something very prophetic. He foreshadows something. He says, my son, God will provide himself a lamb for the offering. And they went on together. He tells Isaac, God is going to provide a lamb. Now, I don't think Abraham realized how true that statement really was. First of all, I think he probably was lying to his son right there. He's just saying, oh, God's going to provide the lamb. Knowing that he didn't want to say, you're the lamb. You're the sacrifice. But he got there, of course, and when he went to sacrifice him, God stopped him. And of course there was a ram caught in the thicket and they used that instead. But you have to wonder about Isaac's faith as well, to allow his father. I mean, you think about, he wasn't just a little bitty boy. He's old enough to recognize, hey, we've got the wood, we've got the fire. And Abraham's well over 100 years old by this time. So you got a young man and an old man. I have a feeling Isaac could have gotten away if he'd have wanted to. Isaac also shows some faith. But we see the picture. In this case, God spared Abraham's son. But the foreshadowing of the time when he would sacrifice his own son and he wouldn't spare him. There was no other. When Abraham says God will provide a lamb, Jesus is that lamb that God did provide. Not just for Abraham and Isaac, but for all of us. And of course, God himself speaks from heaven on the occasion of Jesus' baptism and said, this is my beloved son. Then, of course, there's Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a priest. He was the priest of God. But he was a priest of God who was not from the tribe of Levi. He came before because he lived in the days of Abraham. Abraham offered a tithe, a tenth, to Melchizedek back in Genesis. And so in Hebrews 7, in verse 17, when he's talking about Christ, he says there, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now there are some people that try to even go so far as to say, well, Melchizedek was a case of Jesus coming before he was Jesus. I don't think that he was. I mean, there are some reasons that people think that, and there are some reasons that I don't think that. But the indication here, though, is not a matter of, well, that's, you know, he was, but you are following that priesthood that came before the Levitical priesthood, before the law of Moses. We're going back to before that law even was in place. Because Jesus was not of the tribe of Levi. So Jesus could not be a priest according to the law of Moses. You had to be of the tribe of Levi in order to be that priest in the law, under the law of Moses, and Jesus wasn't. So there had to be some other priesthood if Jesus was going to be a priest. And so this was already in place. God had already had Melchizedek come to Abraham, and Abraham offered the sacrifices and gave the tithe and did all those things that are done with the priest. And he did all that with Melchizedek before Levi was even born. But then also we see that he is, there is a foreshadowing of Jesus in the place of Moses. And this was the scripture that was read a little while ago. Moses was a faithful servant. He did everything that he was supposed to do, almost. But he was faithful. He wasn't perfect. But he loved God and he served God well. But Moses was just a servant. Jesus is the Son. Moses was never going to inherit the household. Moses was never going to be the ruler of the house. But Jesus, as the Son, is the ruler of the house, not just a servant. And so we see that picture there that Moses and Jesus, Moses himself says, speaking of Jesus, we understand it. Interestingly enough, the Muslims understand Moses to be speaking of Muhammad when they read that passage. And others, the Jews, are still waiting for the passage to be fulfilled. But Moses himself says, "The Lord shall raise up for you a prophet like myself, and you shall heed him in all things." Now, of course, some people say, well, he was talking about passing it on to Joshua, and they were supposed to listen to Joshua just like they'd listened to him. And he did that, and they did that, and that was, yes, that happened. But Moses was prophesying about a time to come when there was going to be another prophet. There was going to be a new law. He didn't mention the law there, but he mentions that this prophet is going to be coming. Somebody's going to be coming that's going to be teaching new things, and you need to listen to him. Jeremiah more clearly states that when he talks about the law and how the law was going to pass away and God was going to make a new covenant with his people. And Jeremiah makes that much clearer than that one that Moses. But Moses is looking forward. There's going to be another prophet. There's going to be somebody else you're going to need to listen to. Now we're just so you know, we're just looking at the people tonight. We're not going to look at the things. We'll look at that another time. So that's where we're getting close. Joshua. You know, it's interesting. In Hebrew, the name Joshua and the name Jesus, I mean, they sound very different to us in English, but in the Hebrew, that's the same name. In fact, what we have the angel coming to Mary and said, "You shall name him Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins." In the Hebrew, that would have been, you shall name him Yahshua. And Joshua would have been Yahshua, because the J made the Y sound. You know, kind of how in Spanish it makes the H sound. You know, they say Jesus instead of Jesus. Well, in Hebrew, it was the Y sound. They didn't have the J sound like we have. So it was Yahshua. And that was a word, a name that meant one who saves. Now, at what point that came to mean that, I don't know. That may have been, you know, kind of like a lot of names didn't originally mean something, but they come to mean something. Benedict Arnold means something different now than it did in 1600 because of a certain Benedict Arnold that lived here in what was not yet the United States, the 13 colonies during the Revolutionary War in the late 1700s. Because of that Benedict Arnold, it means something different than it did before. So, I don't know, maybe the name Joshua came to mean the one who saves his people because of the Joshua that we read about in the Bible. I don't know. I don't know how far back that meaning goes. But that's what Joshua did, wasn't it? He delivered his people into the promised land. He brought them to the promised land. Moses had done everything he could, got them out of Egypt. They wandered in the wilderness, and the time came. Joshua had to lead them in. Moses couldn't go into the land, and Joshua had to be the one who led them. Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 6 through 8, though, tells us, since there remains for some to enter into the rest, and those who formerly received the good news failed to enter because of disobedience, again, he appoints a certain day. Today, he says through David, so long after. Now, this is, David wrote after Joshua's time, far after. David says, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. And then verse 8, for if Joshua, now some translations may actually say Jesus there, but it shouldn't. It's Joshua. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day. So he's telling us that Joshua brought his people into the physical promised land, the land of Canaan. But that was all he could do for them. But Jesus brings better promises. He brings better blessings. The new covenant has something more to offer than just a physical promised land that we can go to. Instead, it's spiritual blessings. He promises us a rest, an eternal rest, not just a temporary rest, but an eternal one. Then we see David. Everyone expected the Messiah to be the son of David. They were expecting him to be like David. That he was going to be a king like David. And David is a shadow of Christ. In Ezekiel chapter 34 and verses 22 through 24, God says, I will rescue my flock. They shall no longer be a prey. I will judge between sheep and sheep, and I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David. Now, Ezekiel lived a couple of hundred years or more after David. So there's no way that Ezekiel is talking about the time of David reigning as king over Israel. So what does he mean? I'll set up over them my servant David, and he shall feed them, and he'll be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. I am the Lord. Well, there's only one explanation for who this David is going to be. The king of Israel. Well, who is the king of Israel? It's Jesus. Jesus was crucified for being the King of the Jews. It's what Pilate put on the sign above him when he killed him. The David that's prophesied in Ezekiel, that's foreshadowed of one who was going to come, that is Jesus to come. And then there's also David's heir. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8. Remember that Jesus Christ of the seed of David was raised from the dead according to my gospel, Paul says. God had promised David that he would have an heir to reign on the throne forever. Wasn't Solomon. Solomon died. Wasn't just meaning a continuation of the physical lineage. Those kings ended after Josiah, a good king, died at an early age. He was only 35 when he died. And first one son, then a brother, and then, you know, and an uncle, and another son, and you know, they had about three or four kings over a matter of a few months as they were then quickly herded off into captivity. And that was the end of anyone sitting on a throne in Jerusalem. Do you think there's a Jewish king that's going to sit on a throne in Jerusalem? Who's in control of the mountain where the Jerusalem's main headquarters was? The Muslims are in control of that. They're not going to let a Jewish king sit on a throne there. People try to do all sorts of crazy things with prophecy and stuff to try to make it the king of England and all sorts of things. It's amazing the things that the kinds of claims that they make about how to, in order to try to fulfill this. Because they're trying to make it physical. And they forget. Jesus is the heir, Paul says. And he's raised from the dead, and he is reigning, and he is the king, and he will continue to be the king. From now to the end of time. And has been already reigning for 2,000 years. And then, of course, there's Jonah. Now we might say, wait a minute, Jonah? I mean, shouldn't the guys who are foreshadows of Christ, shouldn't they be, you know, heroes like Joshua and David? Well, I remember David had his problems too. Moses had his problems too. Jonah is the only one of these that Jesus specifically mentions as being something that foreshadowed him. He mentions Jonah. In Matthew 12, verses 39 through 41, he says, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and there will not be a sign given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." And then he explained, because it would say, well, what does that mean? Does that mean the sign is you're going to go preach to Nineveh? What does that mean? Now here he explains. "For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." In the grave, in other words. He said, there's your sign. I'm going to die and be buried for 3 days and 3 nights. Just like Jonah was in the whale for 3 days and 3 nights, I'm going to be in the earth for 3 days and 3 nights. And then he says, the men of Nineveh are going to rise up in judgment with this generation, and they'll condemn it because they repented when Jonah preached. And one greater than Jonah is here. Well, there's no doubt Jesus was greater than Jonah. No doubt about it at all. Well, the amazing thing about it is that Christ's shadow was intended to and does go forward as well as backwards. Not only are these Old Testament heroes, foreshadows of Jesus, but we are also to be reflections of Him, shadows of Him in our own lives. In Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, Paul explains, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. When people look at us, they may not see an exact replica of Jesus Christ, but they should certainly see a shadow. They should see something that's recognizable as being a reflection or a shadow, an image. Maybe sometimes a crude drawing. Maybe we don't live up to Jesus' perfect standard, for sure. But they should be able to recognize His impact in our lives. As Paul says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. I hope that Christ is living in you today. I hope that you've enjoyed learning or being reminded of these foreshadows of Christ from the Old Testament. But more importantly, I hope that you will make sure that Christ's light shines forth in your life, that His shadow is seen living in you and through you each and every day. If you're here and you have a need to respond to the invitation, please come as we stand and as we sing.